We're talking about peat moss on this edition of Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Over thousands of years, plant materials submerged underwater in bogs, they break down to form a type of soil called peat. And the most common is peat from the sphagnum moss plant, which is what we're focused on today. Marshy areas of the northwest part of our state are home to this prehistoric plant that can hold 20 times its weight in water. What questions do you have about sphagnum moss? What do you want to know about this unusual plant and its place in Wisconsin history? We're at 800-642-1234 to join in. David Epstein is CEO and he's owner of Moser Lee in Millston, Wisconsin, which grows and sells a sphagnum moss. David, welcome to the Ideas Network.
No, well, thank you, Kate. Glad to be here.
The coolest thing about the show is you never know what you're going to end up talking about, right? So tell us what sphagnum moss is and give us an overview of it.
Well, sphagnum moss is a plant, and unlike peat moss, sphagnum peat, which you mentioned earlier, sphagnum is the growing plant that, when it decomposes, becomes that sphagnum peat. Our marshes here in west central Wisconsin grow the plant, and we harvest that plant for use in horticultural purposes and a number of other uses. It's kind of an interesting plant in and of itself. It's a non-vascular plant, which means that it doesn't get any of its nutrients from a root system. All of its nutrients for it to grow comes through its leaves. It's a stalk of about 10 to 12 inches long, and it's what's so interesting about it is that it has its small leaves have only a single cell, a structure on it, which makes it perfect for absorbing water and doing other things with the cell structure of the plant. It grows in dense clumps, and it grows in water. And our marshes here in Jackson County, Jackson, Monroe, Clark, and Wood counties grow this product very, very well because of the moist area in the marshes that exists here.
Is that why it grows in Wisconsin but not in other states?
Well, actually, no. It at one time, from what we can do from our research, is that it covered most of Canada and down into Wisconsin, into Michigan, Minnesota, and the northern part of the United States. And actually all around the globe, we believe that it covered that. It's a prehistoric plant. The reason that it's here is because of the glacial action that took place about 10,000 years ago. The glacier, the Wisconsin Glacier it was called, came down and about near Wausau, it split and went around this area, which is commonly referred to as the driftless zone.
Mm-hmm.
So that which existed north of us was dug out by the glacier and never grew back. But in our area, the glacier left a large lake, the Wisconsin Glacial Lake it was called, and our area was covered with that water for thousands of years. The moss survived underneath that water, which is another interesting aspect of it, in that it can survive underwater, and it can survive if it's frozen. So once the water recedes, once it thaws out, it will continue to grow.
We're learning. Go ahead.
And that's what's really happened on why it is here and does not exist in a lot of the other countries and, of course, the other states in the United States.
We're learning about a prehistoric plant that grows here in Wisconsin. David Epstein is our guide, and he owns Moser Lee, which produces sphagnum moss. Have you used sphagnum moss in your home or at your business? How do you find it useful? Or did the plant not work as you expected? What stories can you share? You have a line at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So when did people really start using sphagnum moss, David, and how did they use it historically?
Well, historically, it's been used in this part of Wisconsin to for wound preservation. So you have a wound and you put that on it, and because of its antibacterial uses, it's got it's good for wounds. And we have some research that says that the early Americans would use it as diapers for children and for, as I said, for wounds. In World War I, it was used as sponges during surgeries. There are a number of accounts during that time when sponges that were typically used for that were not available. It's used for a number of things in history. In fact, when I did some research for the EPA on sphagnum recently, I found that there were about 2,000 patents that were filed all over the world, many of them Russian and Chinese patents, that talked about the uses that you could use it. Some of the more interesting ones I found was that there was a patent issued by Johnson & Johnson that relates to using sphagnum moss as a liquid absorbent medium suitable for use in disposable absorbent articles like sanitary napkins and diapers and the like. There's another patent, a world patent, that was issued that that deterred odors from rotting meat in some environments. And then, of course, there are a lot of uses for it that are specific for horticultural purposes. And here in the United States, most of the patents that have been filed and most of the research that's been done has been used for horticultural purposes, for propagation and the like. And that's what we typically use it for, too. Our customers are normally horticulturists or gardeners, and they use it for hanging baskets and a number of uses like that.
So still today, we're figuring out ways to use this moss, and in some sophisticated ways, you know, whether it's in the surgical suite or in the garden. Why is it so versatile?
Well, it's got two properties that we tend to use in the sphagnum product. One of them is that it holds 20 times its weight in water, and that's because of the unique cell structure within the plant. Each one of the cells has a hole in it, which is kind of interesting. And I like to describe it. It looks kind of like your shoe in that there's a hole, and then there's the surface area that exists inside the cell, inside the shoe, and then on the outside. And it's got a unique property of being able to attract water molecules. So the water molecules get stuck inside, so it holds that water from evaporation for a very, very long time. The second interesting property is that it is sterile. It's got some antibacterial qualities to it, and we're not quite sure exactly why. One of the patents that I read recently talked about its low pH. So we know that it's got a pH of between 3 and 4.5, which is more acidic, and that would restrict bacteria from attacking it. But we also know that it can attract certain elements. It can attract nitrogen molecules, for example. It can hold chlorine molecules better than almost anything else. So it's kind of an interesting cellulose that's in it that has these properties, which lends it to a whole lot of uses that we're using today and some that we just don't know yet.
Talking with David Epstein, who owns Moserly in Milston, producing sphagnum moss. How do you use it? Have you found it while hiking or exploring northwestern Wisconsin? Let's talk about it. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're learning about sphagnum moss in Wisconsin. It's Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for joining us. It's a long-stranded moss variety used by gardeners often to line hanging baskets, to protect stem cuttings, to grow tropical plants. What do you want to know about this unusual plant and its place in Wisconsin history? What do you want to know about growing sphagnum moss in Wisconsin and then shipping it to customers all over the world? What questions do you have about Wisconsin's so-called invisible industry? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. David Epstein is owner of Moserly in Millston, which grows and sells sphagnum moss. So, David, where did we start to call this the invisible industry? How did that come about?
It's kind of an interesting story. The interstate highway was put through, I-94 was put through Millston many years ago in the 1970s, and state historians came to the company here and asked my father, who was one of the founders of the company, what was sphagnum moss, because they hadn't heard about it. And as they were talking about it and he was describing it, they said, well, it sounds to me like it's one of Wisconsin's invisible industries because nobody knew anything about it. And it got labeled that. As a matter of fact, there's a plaque that exists on the highway just by a wayside that's a few miles from us that has a plaque on sphagnum moss, and it's called Wisconsin's invisible industry.
So can you find it pretty commonly in garden stores? Where do you pick it up?
You can. We ship it to retailers for consumer use all over the United States. It can be purchased at lawn and garden centers, independent centers, large chains, Home Depot, Ace stores, and the like, all over. And it's typically used, which is kind of, we talk about the uses that it has for it, but people really know it more from a hanging basket standpoint, Kate, as you just mentioned. And it's used to line hanging baskets, wire type of baskets, and then planting in it. And what we've discovered is that when you use a substitute product like cocoa fiber or one of the other ones that looks nice, water tends to go right through it. And in Chicago, where they use these baskets that are lined with sphagnum moss, they have found that they can cut down the number of times that they water these on the streets by half, because the water is absorbed into the moss and holds it there by the roots where it's necessary and doesn't fall through.
So what does it do for your tropicals, your tropical plants?
Well, tropical plants need a moist environment, but not a soggy environment. They don't like to exist in standing water. So because the moss can absorb the water and hold it away from the roots until the roots need it, they love that type of environment. Same thing with succulents. We manufacture a wreath that's made out of long-fibered sphagnum moss that's used to plant succulents for the table or for hanging on the wall. So it is because it is holds so much water, and because it doesn't allow the bacteria, and these tropical plants are very susceptible to death through bacterial action, and because it resists that bacteria, it creates an environment that they can grow and thrive.
So would you say your customer base is mostly garden center type places and florists, or is it other types of businesses?
It's actually not florists as much as it is garden centers where people would buy the product to do the hanging baskets, or it can be used as a soil cover on a potted plant inside a house. It's also used for air layering, which is a method of propagating by cutting a branch on a tree and growing another tree from that branch. It's a seed starter, too. In fact, back in 1944, the USDA put out a bulletin on how sphagnum moss was one of the best seed starters that one could use. We manufacture from our sphagnum moss a seed starter called No Damp Off that prevents disease from getting into the seeds.
We're talking with David Epstein. He owns Mazerly in Millston, growing and selling sphagnum moss, and has been doing it for decades now, family business. What questions do you have about Wisconsin's so-called invisible industry? What do you want to know about growing sphagnum moss or how it is shipped all over the world? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So let's go to harvest now. David, how do you harvest this moss, and what is that like?
Yeah, well, if you can imagine a marsh with the water as high as your knee, the moss grows in clumps, and it grows there. So we have to get in there. Years ago, we have some photos of people mossing back in the 1880s, and they moss with a pitchfork, and they pull it because you have to disconnect the moss from the ground. And we used to use a pitchfork with its tines hanging down, and you put it into the clump, and then you'd pull. And we refer to harvesting as pulling moss because that's, in fact, what you need to do. You need to pull it. We found, because of labor shortages back in the 80s, that it was pretty impossible to get people to do this very hard work. So we developed a harvest equipment that goes into the marsh and actually does the picking and then puts it on the old cleat tracks that we draw out that takes to our drying beds. Because it's wet and so wet, we need to dry it, and we still use the old method today of sun and air drying it.
So are you in harvest right now then?
Well, it's been so wet here in west central Wisconsin that mm-hmm. we haven't been able to get into the marshes yet. Most of our marshes look pretty much like lakes, so we're waiting for the water to go down before we can get our equipment and our men in there.
So how quickly does it grow? Can you harvest it very often?
No, that's another sad part about it, is that it takes about 7 to 10 years to grow back to a length of about 10 to 12 inches where we can harvest it again. It's a renewable plant because of its sporing that creates the next generation of plants, but it takes that long, and primarily because of the winters here. During the winter, growth stops. So when the marshes freeze, there's no growth during that period of time. I was recently in China, and they do grow some moss in China for their own use, and they grow the same amount of sphagnum in about 3 years in a climate where it does not have the freeze and thaw like we do here in Wisconsin. So about 7 to 10 years, we can go back into the marshes. The marshes that we've been on have been harvested for at least 155 years.
Mm. How much of the world's sphagnum moss production comes from Wisconsin? Do you know?
Well, we have about, we figure about half of the world's sphagnum is here. We have the largest marsh in the world. We've got it's close to about 1,000 acres. It also grows in Chile and Argentina. It grows in Japan, a little bit in Norway, and then in New Zealand. And all of those places where it grows has had the same type of glacial action that we have here in Wisconsin, that it was left during the last glacier. But we have about half of the sphagnum moss reserves, we believe, here in the state of Wisconsin.
David, how did your family ever get into this niche production business?
My family grew up in Hartford, Wisconsin, and shortly after my father was born, they moved to Chicago. When he was just graduating from high school, he was looking for work, and he and his father drove north into Wisconsin. One day's drive was this small town called Millston, about 200 people, and they spent the night here, and when they got up in the morning, they were amazed at all the pine trees and the beauty that was here, and asked the owner of the motel what the work that was done here, and they said, well, there's a lot of logging, but there's also something that they do out in the marshes called sphagnum moss. So my father and grandfather took a look at that and thought that there might be an opportunity to sell some of this product back in Chicago, and that started the business, 1932.
Do you think that your family will stay in this business for decades to come?
I would certainly hope so. If not our family, we believe that the product is so unique that there's be a lot of demand for it over the course of the next millennium.
Are you seeing any impact from climate change at all?
We have. There are some threats to our process here. The largest threat is deals with water. If the water remains high through climate change or through dams that are upstream or something like that, we're going to find that it's going to be hard to harvest. It's going to be underwater for a longer period of time. We're concerned about deep wells that are around in this area now with the sand mines and how that might change how the water will flow and the like, and even the reclamation of some old sand mines by planting some invasive plants that might disrupt the growth of the sphagnum.
Well, David, thank you so much for visiting with us.
It's just been my pleasure.
David Epstein is president, CEO, and owner of Mazur Lee in Millston, Wisconsin, growing and selling sphagnum moss for decades in his family. It's Wisconsin Weekend here on The Morning Show. Coming up, we explore the state of recreational fishing and lake fishing in advance of our state's free fishing weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network. We're exploring Wisconsin's lakes and free fishing opportunities on this edition of Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This first weekend in June is a really fabulous time to be outside. The free fishing weekend allows you to fish without a license at any of the lakes in our state. And then there are these fish clinics and lots of gear to borrow at the free events organized by the DNR. Have you ever taken part in Wisconsin's free fishing weekend, or are you planning to get out there tomorrow? Do you think it's important to introduce fishing to younger generations? What stories do you have about growing up fishing in Wisconsin, and who took you? What was that memory like to you? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email your story to ideas@wpr.org. Steve Carpenter is Director Emeritus of the Center for Limnology at the UW-Madison. He's been researching recreational fisheries for about 40 years now. Steve, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
All right. So who got you hooked? Who introduced you to fishing?
Well, many people in my family fished, my grandfathers and my father, and I don't remember, a single event that got me fishing, but it was very common for us to go fishing, even when I was very small boy, 5 or 6 years old.
So when did you know that you loved it and this would be a passion of yours?
Oh, probably when I was 12 or so, I got interested in tying flies and started to trout fish. And, by then, I think I really knew I was hooked.
So what led you to studying freshwater systems and ecology? What's so interesting there?
Well, I have always enjoyed being out in the natural world. My grandfather had a farm. I loved being there. I helped with chores, but I just wandered and just learned by looking. And college, I had the opportunity to go to Glacier National Park. I got hired in Glacier National Park by a fire survey project. And we were surveying forests and fuel. And with a friend of mine, we walked every day, backpacked every day, 5 days a week, recording data and occasionally dodging a grizzly bear or huddling in the tent during rainstorms. And I realized, wow, I can get paid for this. What a great job.
Well, let's talk about our lakes here in Wisconsin. And I first want to clear the air. Is Lake Mendota really the most studied lake in the United States?
Well, it's even up with Lake Geneva in Switzerland. The science of limnology began at essentially the same time within a year or so on both lakes. So, you know, we've just got to kind of duke it out with the Swiss. Figure out who's really got the best studied lake.
Lake Geneva, though, is very gorgeous from the pictures I've seen.
Oh, it is. It's a beautiful sight, and of course, Lake Mendota can be beautiful as well.
So, what is the role of recreational fisheries in our state?
Well, globally, worldwide, in developed countries, one person in 10 fishes for recreation. And I don't have a number for Wisconsin, but I suspect it's even higher for Wisconsin. And so that means that it's a very important way for people to contact nature, interact with the natural world. We're a nation of people that increasingly spends our lives behind screens, looking at our cell phones or looking at our computers or looking at TV. And we often don't have enough actual contact with the natural world. And fishing is one way of getting it. Of course, there are lots of other things. You can take a walk in the woods, go bird watching, have a backyard garden. Fishing is a popular way for just interacting with nature.
We're exploring our Wisconsin lakes as we gear up for free fishing weekend. And I remember as a kid walking to Lake Harriet in Minneapolis and casting a line with my dad at the dock. And I tried once putting an Oreo cookie on my hook and it didn't work out, but we caught sunnies. Steve Carpenter is Director Emeritus of the Center for Limnology at the UW-Madison. He's been researching recreational fisheries a long time now. You can join in. What's your story about fishing as a youngster? Who did you go out with, and what did they teach you about fishing and about life? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Steve, how are we doing in managing and maintaining our lakes?
Well, I would say Wisconsin's lakes and streams are mostly in great shape for fishing. And we have a long history of science-based management here in Wisconsin by Wisconsin DNR's professional managers. And they've done a good job. So I think you will, especially at this time of year, I think you will find the waters in good condition.
How are we doing managing climate change?
Well, we're not managing climate change. We're just letting it happen. And climate change is related to some of the major problems that we have with our lakes. The toxic algae blooms that will start up in Wisconsin in July and August, and they're very common. Wisconsin has become a poster child for satellite images of polluted lakes due to our toxic blooms in July and August. And that comes from farm runoff. It comes from poor management of manure, mostly. And it flows into the lakes because of big storms. And we're getting more storms and bigger rainstorms due to climate change. So that is one way that that climate change is affecting the lakes. Climate change is also affecting our cool water fisheries. In the past decade or so, there have been serious declines of walleye populations in northern Wisconsin. And walleye is the iconic fish of Wisconsin fisheries, and a number of lakes have lost their walleye stocks. And as a result of a research project that several of us were involved in, I'm not the only scientist by any means, and several institutions were involved. We have found that climate change is the underlying cause there, because the climate change decreases habitat for walleye.
Mm-hmm.
It decreases the amount of water available for them to live. And then we combine that with loss of habitat along the shoreline by shoreline landowners clearing out the tangles of, you know, what looks like a tangle of brush and a fallen tree to you looks like heaven if you're a baby walleye. And by, you know, by cleaning up the shorelines, we have removed a lot of habitat. And walleye cannot take the fishing pressure that they could take in the past. The populations don't have as high a growth rate, and we just can't fish them as hard. And that's very frustrating for many people because walleye is a popular table fish.
Yeah.
And, you know, if by some political miracle of human action we did fix the climate change problem, maybe we would get walleye back in the future.
Let's take a call now. Let's go to Paula joining us from Oshkosh. Hi, Paula.
Good morning. Thanks so much for taking my call. I have listening and just wrapped with this program and your guest. It's wonderful. I'm from northern Wisconsin and live now in Oshkosh. And my wonderful father, who's no longer with us on this earth, introduced me to fishing. And I have two fishing poles and a tackle box on the back of my car as we speak. But my mother tells me a story that I was ice fishing with my father, and she claims I was 3 years old, and I took off my gloves, and they said, Paula, put your gloves back on, honey. It's too cold. And I said, I can't get a good grip on the line.
So, you were hardcore even as a toddler, Paula.
You got that right.
Where do you fish now, may I ask?
So now I just kind of, believe it or not, on my way to and from work, I'll just kind of stop. You know, in Oshkosh, we have the Fox River. We have Lake Winnebago. I get back home to Anigo a lot, and there's the Wolf River. There's all sorts of wonderful trout streams and little lakes all over the place. It's just love it, love it, love it. Mm-hmm. Almost like baseball season, the first crack of the baseball.
Oh, that's a fabulous. Steve, what do you hear there?
Well, I hear somebody who loves fishing, and I know many people like Paula, and it's a very important part of recreation and life in Wisconsin.
We're exploring Wisconsin's lakes and the opportunity to try out fishing this weekend, with the state offering free admission to state parks and trails and no fishing license necessary these first 2 days of June. Fishing equipment is available for loan at more than 50 state parks as well. And we're exploring our inland lakes with Steve Carpenter as our guide. He is Director Emeritus of the Center for Limnology at the UW-Madison. Are you someone who's been fishing for decades? Maybe like Paula, you started in those really early years, age 3. How did you learn? What was it about the sport that you love? Do you try to introduce fishing to others? And did it lead you perhaps to work with water or fish? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to Wisconsin Weekend in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. It's Wisconsin Weekend, and we're headed out to the lake with a pole, some tackle. It's free fishing weekend, and we're talking about the places that you love to cast a line. The DNR is giving nature lovers a free pass this weekend. Admission to all parks is waived for 2 days. That means you can fish and hike and bike and use all trails at no cost. Are you an angler? Do you fish recreationally, maybe commercially? What do you love to catch? What bait do you use and where do you go? Have you fished for decades? Who taught you? Who passed on this passion? Share your story at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Steve Carpenter stays with us, and he is Director Emeritus of the Center for Limnology at UW-Madison. Let's go back to the phones now with Mark joining us from Minocqua. Hi, Mark. What's your question?
Yes, my question is...
Try that again. We're having a hard time hearing you.
Okay. Hello?
Yep, we got you now.
Okay. I was born and raised in Minocqua. I'm 60 now and just here almost, you know, constantly every year. I've never missed a year. And I moved to Lake Winnebago in the Nina area, and I fish there regularly as well. My question is for the Minocqua system. Your guest had mentioned something earlier about the walleye here and the lakes up north. And Minocqua's currently at a 5-year moratorium where no walleyes could be harvested at all. There was some discrepancy on, I was just trying to get to the, what his thoughts were on Minocqua Lake, and is that moratorium something that they
I think we have the gist of what you're saying there, Mark. Steve, what do we know about that moratorium on Minocqua?
Well, it was a very bold and forward-looking move by the citizens of the Minocqua area to try this experiment in reduced harvest to allow their walleyes to recover. And it is being followed by Department of Natural Resources, I am told, and I think the results are going to be very interesting. I am not personally involved in that experiment, but I read about it in the news, read about it in the Lakeland Times, and other news sources, and I was very interested to see that people were concerned enough and cared enough to try that experiment, and I think the whole state is going to benefit from knowing the results when they come out.
Well, Steve, there are lots of lakes to fish out there, so what are some of the most popular places to go? Where do you like to fish?
Well, you're asking me to reveal secrets. I know in the media, you people in the media have the phrase "in an area lake." That's where I caught that nice fish. Was in an area lake.
Yeah, you're onto our tricks. All right.
But I usually fish when I do fish. I should preface this by saying that now that I am a researcher on recreational fishing, oddly, I don't fish that much, but because I'm busy studying fishing instead of fishing. But I tend to fish up in the Trout Lake area where the university has a field station, and I tend to fish in the in southwest Wisconsin where my wife and I have a cabin.
So how can you help to get more people into fishing, into this sport, and protect fisheries at the same time?
Well, that's a great question. And an interesting fact is that a recent poll of people who like to fish found out that the major reason people give for fishing is to enjoy nature with family members and friends. It's not to catch fish. It's they like to have the possibility of catching fish. because when you catch one, it's exciting. It's like you wouldn't go to the casino unless there was a chance you could win. But what they really enjoy is the chance to be in a beautiful place with friends and family members. And catching fish is secondary. So I think that gives some hope that people would be willing to moderate their harvest.
Well, Steve, we have to end it there. Thank you so much for the visit. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, sure. Thank you.
Steve Carpenter is Director Emeritus of the Center for Limnology at the UW-Madison. We have all the links to Free Fishing Weekend and where you can find the DNR events and fishing regulations. Go to WPR.org and click on the Morning Show page. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about one of the most famous musicians in the world who will be touring in Wisconsin next week.
Paul McCartney first came to Wisconsin in September 1964 when the Beatles played their only show in the state. Writer Dean Robbins tells us about the madness that greeted them on their first American tour. This story first aired in 2013, just after McCartney played Miller Park.
I'm one of those crazy Beatle fans who want to know every single thing about the band. Luckily, every single thing has been documented, and it seems like there's always more to learn. Lately, I've been obsessing on the Fab Four's appearance in Milwaukee on September 4th, 1964. It was their only trip to Wisconsin, and it was a memorable one. So memorable that people are blogging about it almost 50 years later. The madness started the minute the Beatles' plane landed in Mitchell Field. Hundreds of fans showed up to swoon at the sight of them.
I just like George.
I like George.
But the 80 police officers on hand wanted nothing of the sort, so they arranged for the plane to land far away from the crowd.
They are on their way to their hotel at this time.
Then they shuttled the Beatles through a back exit where no one could see them. The band complained to no avail. Later, at a press conference, Paul McCartney accused the police of pulling a dirty trick.
We have been told that the decision to land was made by your manager in the air.
There was no need to take us out the back way. Just at least drive past the fans, you know, in a car. And again, they told us no. And he's a dirty, lying policeman who told you that.
The Beatles didn't treat the local press any more respectfully than they did the local police. A reporter asked them what they planned to do when their bubble burst. Guitarist George Harrison answered.
Call your coffee.
Tickets for the show at Milwaukee Arena topped out at $5.50. Red Cross workers, armed with ammonia inhalants, stationed themselves around the arena to treat fainting girls. As for the performance, it was drowned out by the screaming of 12,000 fans. The screams were so relentless that no one could tell All My Loving from Can't Buy Me Love. Nevertheless, the Beatles rocked, and they playfully engaged the crowd between songs. Everybody there remembers having a good time. Before the band left town, McCartney took a minute to call a local fan in the hospital. He had heard she didn't get a chance to see the show. The band may have had no use for Wisconsin's disapproving elders, but they loved the kids who responded so passionately to their music. I should tell you why I've been obsessing on the Beatles' visit to Milwaukee. It's because I got to see a Beatle there myself this past July. Paul McCartney performed at a sold-out Miller Park, with ticket prices well over $5.50. In many ways, though, the performance made me think of 1964. Paul still playfully engaged the crowd. And at age 71, he still rocked with a vengeance. When he launched into All My Loving, a number he'd also sung with the Beatles in Milwaukee, I couldn't help myself. I screamed.
Dean Robbins is a journalist and author based in Madison. This story first aired in 2013 after Paul McCartney played Miller Park. This month, he'll be playing in Madison and in Green Bay. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And Wisconsin Life is part of our weekly edition of Wisconsin Weekend here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on the Ideas Network.